dreadful day in American history, and when 5 Americans died and more were wounded, I knew this was the beginning of a revolutionary war. Chapter 8. On a crisp winter morning, we landed alongside a large red brick building. The bottom level looked like a marketplace where several merchants, fishermen, meat and produce sellers, and peddlers of every kind were selling their goods. The second level had several windows. Some were opened, and many voices could be heard inside. "You realize we landed a day after the Boston Massacre, right?" Liberty said. "Is this March 6, 1770?" I asked. "Yes, but you said the massacre happened on March 5th, Liberty reminded me. "Oh, yeah, I'm aware of that," I whispered. "But I didn't want my students to witness the Boston civilians who died." "Why is it that the past always seems colder than the future?" said Freedom. "It's freezing out here." I reached for my travel bag and handed Freedom and Cam their colonial clothes. "Put these clothes over your modern-day clothes. You should be warmer with a double layer." Freedom and Cam eagerly put on the clothes like they were racing each other. "I want the two of you to stay close to me," I said. "Let's walk to the front of the building and see where we are." "Why don't we just ask Liberty?" said Cam. "Isn't he supposed to have special powers that let him know when and where we are?" Liberty closed his eyes and concentrated before saying, "We're definitely in Boston, and this building is... I can see the name. I'm not sure I can pronounce it." "Faneuil Hall," said Freedom. "Must be a French name." "How did you know that?" asked Cam. "Because I read Liberty's mind," Freedom said, smiling. "You can read minds?" asked Cam with a worried expression on his face. "Don't worry, I can only communicate with animals, but I do have X-ray vision." "What?" Cam blurted out as he walked behind Liberty. "Just kidding," Freedom laughed. "But wouldn't that be cool?" Liberty said. "Boy, I wish I had X-ray vision." "You don't need it," I said. "You have your time travel sense. Can you sense Samuel Adams in this building?" Liberty paused and then said, "Yep, he is definitely in there." "And Faneuil Hall's a special building," I said. "It served as the Patriot headquarters or meeting place to discuss the Stamp Act, the Boston Massacre, the Tea Crisis, and other British laws that burdened the colonists." "Where's Liberty?" Freedom asked. We turned, spotted Liberty near the front of Faneuil Hall. He was staring at what looked like a sign. We followed Liberty. As we got closer, I read the sign that had caught his complete attention. It read, "Faneuil Hall, Boston, the Cradle of Liberty, dedicated in 1763 in the cause of liberty." "Have you ever seen anything so beautiful?" asked Liberty, who was nearly crying. "Although I don't remember sleeping in a cradle. In fact, I don't think I'd fit inside a cradle unless it was a giant one. Oh, well, hey, take a picture of me beside the sign." After a quick photo, I said, "Let's look inside the building." "Well, what are we looking for?" asked Freedom. "I want to meet Samuel Adams," I said. "Today he's giving an impassioned speech about last night's horrific events." Liberty replied, "I'm going to sit this one out. I mean, I'm glad this Adams guy's on our side, but I don't want to risk getting yelled at." "Why do you say that?" Freedom asked, a little worried. I interjected, "From what I've learned, Samuel Adams is not a patient person. But I'm sure he's..." "Wait, you said he was pig-headed. He needs anger management classes," Liberty said. "Well, I've never actually met the man. It's just what I've read in history books," I said defensively. "So why are we meeting him?" Cam asked. I sighed and explained, "Samuel Adams may not have the genius and social skills of Benjamin Franklin, and he may not be as brilliant and lighthearted as Patrick Henry, but he definitely played an important role in America's independence. Let me tell the three of you something that I hope you never forget. You will meet people in your life that get on your nerves. Maybe they challenge your ideas, or they're not willing to completely agree with you. That does not mean they're bad people. Yes, Samuel Adams was said to be a stubborn and quick-tempered man, but I think we'll see that he was an incredible motivator. The point is, I believe that God knew he would need different people with a variety of personalities to create a free America. He needed men and women who weren't afraid to speak their minds. He needed people who would not back down. Frankly, this country needs more of that today. Our country needs kids like you to speak up when our liberties are being threatened. Our forefathers said and did hard things, even when they knew it might not be the popular thing. Samuel Adams is one of those people. He wasn't trying to win a popularity contest. He was trying to motivate people to take a stand and fight for their liberties. "Thanks, Mr. Revere," said Cam. "I know peer pressure makes a lot of kids go along with the crowd, even when they know it's not the right thing." "Yeah, thanks, Mr. Revere," echoed Freedom. "My mom named me Freedom because she hoped that it would give me the courage to stand up to others who might take advantage of me. I don't do a very good job at that. But now I'm anxious to meet Samuel Adams. Maybe I can pick up a few tips from him." "No kidding," agreed Cam. "Okay, let's go meet the Samulator."
"The what?"
Liberty said. "You know, like the Terminator. The Samulator." "Oh, well, good luck with that. I'll meet you outside when you're finished," Liberty said. As we entered the front doors, I noticed the hall inside was packed with people from the entrance all the way to the platform on the other side. The man standing near the podium was dressed in simple colonial fashion. He looked like he was in his late 40s. I immediately felt his penetrating stare, which seemed to reach all the way across the room and into my soul. And when he started to speak, I knew instantly that this was the exceptional American Samuel Adams. "There he is," I said. "That's the Samulator?" asked Cam.
"Show some respect," said Freedom. "It's Samuel Adams."
"Yes, that's him," I said, mesmerized by what he was saying. Samuel looked over the crowd and boldly said, "The governor of Massachusetts says that I'm the great incendiary. He says I spread lies about the British Empire, and I spread stories about the injustices of the king. But I will tell you that my purpose and my passion is to warn against the hostile designs of Great Britain." The crowded room erupted with shouts and cheers. Samuel Adams continued, "Furthermore, I accept your nomination to chair a committee that will petition Governor Hutchinson for the immediate removal of British troops from the city of Boston." "Hear, hear!" shouted members of the crowd. "America should never forget the horrid massacre in Boston," said Samuel, "when 5 innocent patriots were shot by British muskets. We will honor men like Crispus Attucks, who was the first to fall, struck twice in the chest by bullets." Again, the crowd erupted with anger. It was beginning to look and sound like a mob.
"That's harsh," said Cam. "I remember hearing the gunshots in the classroom. I bet that's when the patriots got shot."
"Yeah," said Freedom, "but I don't like that innocent people are getting killed."
"No kidding," said Cam, somberly.
"And too bad about Crispus Attucks. I've never heard of him before." I whispered, "History tells us that Attucks was of African and Native American descent. He had fled to Boston after escaping his enslavers. In fact, he has a monument in Boston that hails him as a hero of the American Revolution, the first patriot to give his life for the cause. I wonder if he would have still gone to King Street and protested like that if he knew he might die," said Freedom thoughtfully.
"That's a good question, Freedom," I said. "But I think a hero does what needs to be done, says what needs to be said, despite the consequence, even if it means giving your life. And that's why I consider Samuel Adams an American hero. He could have hanged for the things he said, but it didn't stop him."
As the public meeting ended, we weaved our way through the crowded hall and headed toward the podium. "We'll try to introduce ourselves to Samuel Adams. It'd be great to meet him. Ask a few questions," I said. "But I'm not sure I see him anymore."
"Feels like everybody's really fired up," Freedom said.
"No kidding," Cam said. "Feels like we're at a tailgate party before a football game. It's too bad Samuel Adams can't come to a game. I bet he'd be an awesome cheerleader."
Oh, sure, let's invite Samuel Adams to a football game. I'm sure he doesn't have anything better to do, Freedom said. Voice of reason. And just what am I being invited to? Asked Samuel from behind us, and I could hardly believe I was standing face to face with the legendary Samuel Adams. I said, Sir, Mr. Adams, Samuel, or do you go by Sam? I mean, it's a pleasure to meet you. We are huge admirers of yours and fellow patriots. I'm not looking for admirers, stated Samuel, but I am looking to grow the cause of freedom. Now tell me about this football game. Is this a game for patriots? Actually, yes, laughed Cam. The New England Patriots are a football team in Massachusetts. Personally, I like the Broncos, but Freedom elbowed Cam in the ribs. I quickly tried to change the subject and said, These are two of my students, Cam and Freedom, and I am Rush Revere, history teacher and historian. I brought them to hear your speech and hopefully help them understand the importance of fighting for freedom. We were very inspired and motivated by your speech. In fact, we'd love to help support the cause any way we can. Your name is Freedom, you say? Asked Samuel, who turned to look at Freedom. That's a name worth having. That's a cause worth fighting for. Well, I'm not really a fighter, said Freedom. Nonsense! Shouted Samuel. His word made Freedom practically jump. Samuel firmly said, We are born to fight. A baby fights for his first breath. Our hearts fight to beat every second of every day. If you stood between a hungry wolf who was after a younger sister or brother, and you had a club in your hand, what would you do? Freedom looked nervous about answering. Finally said, Well, I would fight it off. What? I didn't hear you. Say it louder, Samuel prodded. Freedom tried again, this time a little louder. I said I would fight off the wolf. Of course you would, Samuel said, sounding almost angry. And King George is simply a wolf that wears a crown. Do you understand? Yes, said Freedom timidly. Don't ever forget that you are a fighter, Freedom. You are worth fighting for. Freedom nodded, gave a weak but sincere smile. Samuel turned toward me and asked, Did you say your name is Rush Revere? Yes, that's right, I said and smiled. I'm a good friend with Paul Revere, fellow patriot here in Boston, said Samuel. In fact, I'm on my way to visit with him now. He is a master silversmith, and I'm in need of his services. Would you care to join me? Really? I asked with wonder. Well, it'd be a great honor to meet him as well. I'm sure we're related. Well, come then, said Samuel. We'll travel together. His shop isn't far from here. Thank you. That is very generous of you, I stammered. I was practically shaking from the anticipation and excitement of meeting my favorite exceptional American, Paul Revere. As we followed Samuel out the doors and down the stairs of Faneuil Hall, a man who I assume was a fellow patriot called to speak with Samuel. Samuel stepped away briefly, and as I waited, I overheard bits and pieces of their conversation, something about a secret meeting. And the Sons of Liberty. Interesting. Cam interrupted and said, Mr. Revere, we found Liberty. He's down by those food vendors. Apparently someone spilled a whole lot of baked beans and Liberty decided he'd help clean things up. Yes, cleaning up food is his specialty, I laughed. Tell him to hurry because we're following Samuel Adams to Paul Revere's silversmith shop. Samuel finished his conversation about the secret meeting and said, I apologize for keeping you waiting. Not a problem, I said. Just lead the way, Mr. Adams. Cam and Freedom followed close behind, and Freedom led Liberty by the halter. The streets of Boston were buzzing with colonists. Their mood seemed somber as they went about their errands. I noticed many dirt streets that branched off from the main cobblestone street that we traveled on. Samuel pointed out several of his favorite shops along Main Street, a tavern, fruit vendor, a bakery, and a barber shop, a hat store, a fish market, a pipe maker, and a flower shop. Merchants lined the streets, and a variety of signs hung over their doors and windows. The hoop petticoat, the four sugar loaves, the chest of drawers, the spring clock and watches were just a few of the signs that caught my eye. For the most part, we have all the luxuries we need. England does ship goods for us to purchase, but I prefer to purchase items made in America, Samuel said. In addition, redcoats could be seen policing the streets, and they traveled together in groups of five or six. We crossed the street whenever redcoats were approaching. In fact, I noticed most of the colonists tried to avoid the British soldiers. And as we walked, Samuel said, Paul Revere is a master silversmith. After he fought in the French and Indian War, he took over his father's shop. Curious, I asked, exactly what kinds of things does he make? I don't think there's anything he couldn't make. He is a true artisan of silver. And is this why you're visiting Paul Revere today? You want to purchase one of his silver pieces, I inquired. No, I'm going to ask Paul to use his skills to engrave a piece of copper. You see, Paul Revere has a small printing press in his shop. Whatever he engraves on a thin piece of copper can be used as a template for his printing press, and the piece of copper can be printed over and over again, said Samuel. And what exactly do you plan to engrave on the piece of copper? Now you get right to the point, Rush Revere. I like that, said Samuel. The British Army has given us a golden opportunity. I've called it the Boston Massacre. In fact, we approach King Street now. This is where the tragedy occurred last night. Overhearing our conversation, Cam said, I recognize the customs office and the old brick church. And indeed, back in the classroom, Liberty had dreamed a remarkable simulation of the crime scene. As we walked to the place where the crowd of colonists stood shouting at the British soldiers, I saw thin patches of snow in the shadows of the buildings. A large icicle fell from a two-story building and shattered into dozens of large chunks. A thick, jagged piece tumbled across the street until it hit my leather shoe. I looked down at the piece of broken ice and I saw a large dark stain on the cobblestone. A cold wind blew across my face. It gave me goosebumps. I knelt to get a better look, and I shivered at the thought of what had happened at this very spot last night. Behind me, Samuel said, I've talked to many witnesses about the event last night, and it appears that the British soldiers indeed fired upon several Americans. However, I have also discovered that the Americans who gathered were not all peaceful bystanders. Most likely some provoked and taunted the soldiers. Sticks and stones and ice were thrown at the redcoats. The angry crowd started pressing in on the nine soldiers. And that's when someone shouted fire, I softly said, remembering the event from the classroom. Correct, said Samuel. My investigation tells me that Captain Thomas Preston ordered his soldiers not to fire. However, by then it was too late. One of his men fired his musket. Soon after, several more shots were fired, killing five unarmed men. It was bound to happen with the Quartering Act, quartering troops so close to the civilian population. It's like putting a fuse so close to a flame. Perhaps both sides are guilty, I said, finally standing and looking at Samuel. Perhaps, said Samuel, my cousin John Adams has been asked to defend the British soldiers who were at the massacre. Only a handful of witnesses will ever know what truly happened. However, I am a big believer that people will believe what we tell them. And I intend to spread the word to help spread the cause of the Patriots. We can use this to our advantage. And this plan involves Paul Revere, I said matter-of-factly. It does, Samuel said. Paul Revere's silversmith shop is not far from here. I looked for Cam and Freedom, and I saw them near Liberty. Freedom was huddled up close against Liberty's neck. I walked over and asked, Are you cold? I'm fine, said Freedom quietly. Cam replied, I guess this is the ugly part of history, eh? Yes, I said. I'm sorry if this was a hard thing to experience. I hadn't planned to. It's okay. I'm glad we came, said Freedom. But it's a weird feeling to think about what happened here last night. Cam agreed. Yeah, I know it's just a street, but it feels like a cemetery. Samuel called from across the street and said, We must be on our way. A cold wind blew again across our faces. It chilled me to the bone, as the image of those who lost their lives seemed to lie very near the stain-filled streets. We continued following Samuel in silence, soon heard the sound of someone pounding metal. "Ah, here we are, Paul Revere's silversmith shop," said Samuel. I was glad we'd arrived. My somber mood changed to wonder as I thought about meeting the one and only Paul Revere. I straightened my coat and felt like I was a little boy again, ready to meet Santa Claus. I peered through the shop window and noticed the most beautiful handcrafted pieces of silver I'd ever seen. Spoons, cups, trays, bowls, teapots adorned the window display. "I like that bowl with the horse engraved on the side of it," said Freedom. "I like it too," whispered Liberty into Freedom's ear. "His craftsmanship is impressive," Samuel said. "Believe it or not, he even crafted a small silver chain for a pet squirrel." I laughed at the thought of it. "Seriously?" laughed Cam. "Well, I wish I could get a picture of that." "Such a picture would be senseless," said Samuel, clearly not seeing the humor of it. As Samuel opened the door, I saw a man sitting behind an anvil. Hot sparks burst between the anvil and the heavy hammer each time it connected with the silver he worked with. I could practically feel the hot furnace from the doorway and certainly smelled the melting metal. As we walked through the doorway, I left the door ajar just a bit so Liberty could hear our conversation. My heart was beating fast, and my palms felt cold and sweaty. I didn't realize how nervous I would feel upon meeting my boyhood hero. I'd met dozens of exceptional Americans, but this one was extra special for me. "Paul, my good friend," said Samuel, "may I introduce you to my new friends, Rush Revere and his students Cam and Freedom." Paul set down his hammer and wiped his brow. He looked like a strong man with broad shoulders and mighty forearms. He wore a leather apron over his linen shirt, which was rolled up at the sleeves. His hair was pulled back into a ponytail. He immediately smiled at me like we were long-lost brothers. "With a last name like that, I'm sure you must be a brilliant man," said Paul, laughing. "It's a pleasure to meet you." He reached out his hand, and I did the same. His handshake was firm, and he looked me straight in the eye. "To what do I owe this visit?" I said, "I am a history teacher and historian, and I have been a great admirer of all you've done for America's independence." Paul laughed heartily, said, "I like this Revere. He speaks of our independence as if it's already happened." "Yes. It seems all the Reveres are true patriots," said Samuel. "I'll tell you why I've come, but first I must show you this drawing." And Samuel unrolled a piece of parchment that he was carrying. I asked a man by the name of Henry Pelham to draw this illustration of the massacre on King Street last night. And he showed it, Paul Revere. "Massacre?" Paul said with a surprised grin. I found myself smiling with him, and not knowing why. It's as if his smile was contagious. Paul said, "Ha! I should not be surprised you chose a word with such drama." Paul laughed again, and I could see that this was a man who loved life. He made me feel right at home in a way that Samuel Adams definitely didn't. He was good at his craft, and his customers probably enjoyed him as much as his handiwork. Paul turned in my direction and said, "Be careful of what Samuel tells you. He's very good at spinning a story to his own benefit. Bending the truth is his specialty." And Paul slapped Samuel on the back and laughed again while Samuel grimaced. Paul continued, "The word massacre makes it sound like the Redcoats were premeditated and cold-blooded." "Some of us fight with swords, some of us fight with words," Samuel said with a glint in his eye. "I call it the Boston Massacre because I want Americans to always remember the horrific event of March 5th, 1770. I peered at the drawing and noticed that it showed British soldiers firing at peaceful Boston citizens. With a bit of anger, Samuel said to Paul, "And why do you criticize me for lighting a fire under our fight for freedom? My intent is to remind all Americans how unjust and unfair King George has been to the colonies. He's trying to cripple our economy by taxing everything. He wants to crush our hopes of independence. He'll stop at nothing until he kills our chance for freedom.
I agree, said Paul, smiling. No need to bark up my tree. Boston's clearly being targeted by the British Empire. King George sends more and more troops to Boston. We must do something.
I assume you have a plan. You always do, Paul said, laughing. Samuel nodded and said, yes, I do. I need the help of a master silversmith to engrave this picture on a copper plate so that we can print and distribute it to as many Americans as possible.
I can do it, said Paul. It'll take some time, but I can do it.
Well, if you can't do it, perhaps the printer and patriot Benjamin Franklin can? Teased Samuel with a serious look on his face.
Paul's laughter bounced off the walls of the small silversmith shop. He said, you really know how to motivate a person.
Surely I was biased, but I loved Paul Revere's attitude. He never seemed to doubt his own ability, and he was always optimistic about getting the job done. I wished I could stay with him all day and listen to his adventures and stories. And just then the door cracked open and Liberty stumbled inside.
Freedom whispered he was listening too closely. He accidentally fell into the door.
Is this your horse? Paul asked, walking to the door.
Yes. I apologize. He's a curious animal, and I'm sure he was just looking for us, I said.
Well, I'm looking for a new horse, said Paul. Would you consider selling him?
No, I couldn't, I said. We've been through a lot together.
Well, before you go, I have a gift for Cam and Freedom, said Paul, and he walked to the back of his shop and then returned with two silver objects.
These are whistles, said Paul proudly. They make a very loud, high-pitched sound. I recommend you use this in case of an emergency only.
He laughed again, and we all laughed with him.
I turned to Samuel Adams and Paul Revere, and I said, I will forever remember this day, gentlemen. Thank you for your dedication and your bravery. As a teacher of history, I'll make sure your names are remembered as exceptional Americans.
We are far from exceptional, said Samuel seriously.
Well, true, but I'm a little closer than Samuel, Paul said jokingly.
As Cam and Freedom left the shop, Samuel lowered his voice and said, I invite you to join our secret society of patriots called the Sons of Liberty. Paul is also a son of liberty. I feel I can trust you. We need good men who have the courage to fight for freedom no matter the cost.
I'm honored, I said without hesitation. I'll find you the next time I'm in town.
As we parted ways, I thought about the commitment I had just made, the commitment that all the Sons of Liberty had made. Their imprint in American history would forever be remembered during the famous Boston Tea Party. As I left the shop, I saw Cam and Freedom sitting on Liberty's saddle. Both were plugging their noses. As I got closer to Liberty, I realized why. What's that smell? I asked, grimacing. And just then Liberty tooted and said, excuse me, I, may have sampled some beans earlier.
Well, let's just say I'll have plenty of gas to get us through the time portal.
I simply shook my head and smiled. It was definitely time to jump back to Manchester Middle School.
Chapter 9. While we waited for the bell that signaled the end of the fire drill, Liberty quickly exited the classroom.
Did you see the look on Liberty's face? Cam asked as he started laughing. So funny! He kept passing gas every time he took a step.
I know, right? Said Freedom with a big grin. Even after he turned invisible, we could still hear him tooting all the way down the hallway.
Their laughter was contagious. Tommy walked over and whispered, I still can't believe you time-jumped without me.
Freedom replied, oh, I almost forgot. This is for you.
Freedom handed Tommy her silver whistle.
I'm not much of a whistleblower, and since you couldn't come, I want you to have it.
Paul Revere made it.
Wow.
Thanks, Freedom, Tommy said, gave Freedom a giant grin.
When the bell rang, Freedom said, gotta catch my ride. Bye, and thanks again for the field trip.
But I'm still jealous I didn't get to go with you guys, said Tommy to Cam.
Well, it just sort of happened, Cam said. And plus, you and Elizabeth got to time jump when you visited King George.
Speaking of Elizabeth, I didn't see her when class returned, I said.
Oh, yeah, Tommy said softly. I almost forgot. I spoke with her outside while we waited for the fire alarm to stop. She kept talking about King George III and how excited she was to see him again. I told her I didn't think we were going back there. And she said, yes, we are, Thomas. Oh, I just hate when she calls me that. What else did she say? I asked. Tommy looked around the room to make sure we were alone and said, ever since she came back from Windsor Castle, she's been acting really strange. He did his best Elizabeth impersonation.
Oh, Thomas, it's my destiny to return to England. I have plans, and they involve King George.
Hey, you sound just like her, Cam said and laughed. The two boys high-fived each other, and Tommy said, so anyway, I asked her what her plans were. I told her maybe I could help. I was curious to know what she's up to.
And what did she say? Cam asked.
Again, pretending to be Elizabeth, Tommy said, oh, Thomas, wouldn't you like to know?
Cam raised one eyebrow
and said, on second thought, you probably shouldn't talk like that. It's sort of creeping me out. Tommy chuckled. Anyway, while we were waiting for the fire drill to end, a couple of kids were throwing a football back and forth, but one of their passes went wide. It soared like a heat-seeking missile headed right for Elizabeth.
Let me guess.
Kablam! Cam said.
Yep, it was a direct hit.
Her books and folders and papers went everywhere, and as soon as those kids saw what happened, they ran away like a quarterback running from a linebacker.
Well, I don't blame them, I said, smiling. Elizabeth is a pretty mean linebacker.
Anyway, I'm not sure what came over me, said Tommy, but I decided to help her gather her things, and that's when I came across this. And he pulled out a folded piece of paper that was stuffed into his pocket. I saw the words Top Secret written on it, so I snatched it when she wasn't looking, and he handed the paper to me. I unfolded the note and then smoothed out the paper. The note had a few words written on three lines. The first line said, jump to Great Britain. The second line said, impress the king. The third line said, tell secret about BTP. And underneath that were several signatures. The one said, Queen Elizabeth. Another said, President Elizabeth. And a third said, Elizabeth the Great.
You know, she definitely bumped her head back in the 18th century. She's nuts, Cam said.
What does BTP stand for? Asked Tommy. British toilet paper?
Cam laughed and said, maybe it stands for Boston triple cream pie. I love a good pie.
Now that's something Liberty would say, I said. But wait a second.
I think you're on to something, Cam.
I am, Cam replied, confused. You think Elizabeth's secret's about a pie recipe?
No, I corrected. I think her secret's about Boston. In particular, a secret event that'll happen in Boston, a big secret that involves a lot of tea.
Oh, Cam said, snapping his fingers.
BTP, Boston Tea Party, of course.
Exactly, I exclaimed. If the king knew about the Boston Tea Party before it happened, well, he could probably stop it. It could be the beginning of the end of the American Revolution.
Tommy raised his hand like he was in class. What exactly is the Boston Tea Party, and why would Elizabeth plan something like that?
Elizabeth isn't planning it, I said. The Boston Tea Party is a secret mission planned by the Sons of Liberty.
Liberty has sons? Asked Tommy, surprised.
No, no. I'm referring to a secret organization called the Sons of Liberty. It was a well-organized group of patriots who banded together to resist the British and unfair laws like the Stamp Act. The Sons of Liberty were sort of like Robin Hood and Batman mixed into one. When the colonists were burdened and suffering because of King George and his minions, the Sons of Liberty would come to the rescue. Their most famous operation was the Boston Tea Party.
Cool! Tommy was smiling. I wish I could be a Son of Liberty. What else did they do, Mr. Revere?
They once tried to persuade Governor Thomas Hutchinson of Massachusetts to reject the Stamp Act in his official letters to London. The governor was a loyalist, so of course he refused. In fact, Governor Hutchinson sent and received many letters to and from England, and these letters made it very clear that the British were superior. King George and his parliament thought the colonists were sloppy and stupid, so they granted fewer rights to people living in America. Simply, the letters said Britain was better and America was black. Governor Hutchinson agreed, and that made the Sons of Liberty really mad. So they attacked the governor's mansion. They axed his door. They uprooted his garden, destroyed much of his home. Of course, they didn't harm the governor, but they told him that he didn't belong in America. Eventually, he left Massachusetts and returned to England. "Okay, wait, now back up," said Tommy. "You said the Sons of Liberty were the ones who planned the Boston Tea Party." "A tea party? I don't get it. I mean, my little sister likes to have tea parties with all of her friends. I just don't see the Sons of Liberty doing that." Cam laughed. "Not that kind of tea party," he said. I laughed as well and said, "The best way for me to explain it is to simply show you." "Awesome," Tommy said. "Road trip." "Let's go find Liberty," I said. "Yeah, it shouldn't be too hard to find him," Cam smiled. "All we have to do is listen for someone cutting the cheese." Tommy chuckled and said, "Seriously?" "Oh, yeah," Cam said. "He ate a boatload of beans in Boston." After 15 minutes, we found Liberty. He was waiting for us by the big oak tree near the back door of the school. "Everything okay?" I asked. "Well, let's just say I've been better," Liberty said with a half smile. "Are you up to jumping again?" I asked Liberty. "Did the Mayflower make it to the New World? Did Benjamin Franklin invent the lightning rod? Was Paul Revere a master blacksmith?" asked Liberty. "Hanky means yes," Cam said. All the students and buses had left by now, and the schoolyard looked deserted. After Tommy and Cam climbed up onto Liberty's saddle, Liberty said, "Rush! Rush! Rushing to history!" Swirling colors of purple and gold grew to the size of a hobbit hole. As we rushed to the time portal, I said, "December 16th, 1773, Boston, Massachusetts, the Old South Meeting House." We jumped. The next thing I felt was the chilled air. Were we in a field or a park? It was hard to tell since the only light came from the moon and the flickering lanterns and candles in a building straight ahead of us. It looked like an old church with a large steeple that stood like a single sentinel keeping watch over the large crowd of colonists below. The boys quickly jumped off Liberty and put on their colonial clothes over their modern-day clothes. "Must be 5,000 people over there," said Tommy. I nodded. "We are about to witness another key event that brings the 13 colonies that much closer to their revolution against Great Britain." "Can we get a closer look?" asked Cam. "I want to hear what they say." As we approached the front doors to the meeting house, a man rushed outside and pushed his way through the crowd. He wore cream-colored breeches and white stockings, as well as a cream-colored vest buttoned nearly to the neck. His royal blue coat with golden buttons and gold trim hung low to his knees and reminded me of something a ship's captain would wear. The man was searching for something, and when he saw us, he hurried over and said, "I'm in need of a swift horse. I am Mr. Francis Roch, owner of the Dartmouth out of England, and I've been asked to seek a pass from Governor Hutchinson so my ship might return to England with its crates of tea. May I borrow your horse? I expect to return shortly before the governor's answer." Before I could respond, Liberty was enthusiastically nodding his head. He looked excited for this unexpected adventure. I knew Liberty was a fast horse and would enjoy the task of an important mission. I finally said, "Yeah, why not?" "Thank you, my good sir. I shall return shortly," said Francis. And within seconds, he was sitting in Liberty's saddle and dashing off into the night. I turned to the boys and said, "Let's squeeze our way into the meeting house." "I think the Dartmouth is the name of a ship," said Cam. "Yes, that's right," I confirmed. "The Dartmouth is one of three ships that are sitting in Boston Harbor right now with hundreds of crates of tea from England." King George and Parliament are trying to force the colonists to purchase only British tea. In fact, the king has made his tea cheaper than anything else the colonists could buy.
Yeah, but he's also making the colonists pay a tax on the tea, said Cam.
More taxes, said Tommy. King George doesn't give up. I mean, it's pretty obvious the colonies don't want to be taxed by England anymore. You'd think the king would have learned that lesson from the Stamp Act.
History shows that King George III was not a very smart man, I said.
Okay, but wait a second, said Tommy. The guy who rode off on Liberty said that his ship can't leave the harbor without a pass from the governor.
That's right, I said. You see, the Dartmouth arrived in Boston a few weeks ago. A tax has to be paid the moment the cargo of tea is removed from the ship. However, the colonists refused to pay the tax, and therefore don't want the tea to leave the ship. To make matters worse, two more ships have arrived with more tea. So the patriots, the colonists who are fighting for a free America, have posted guards around all the ships so that not a single crate is removed. They want the ships to return to England, but only the governor can approve such a thing.
Okay, I get it. They want the governor to tell the king to jump in a lake because they're not paying the stinking royal tea tax, said Cam.
Well, in a manner of speaking, yes, but the governor is not a patriot. He's a loyalist, remember? He supports the king. So I'm afraid Liberty will return with bad news for the patriots. As we entered the front door, Cam said, "There's a great spot for us right in the corner." There was standing room only, so we shuffled across the wooden floor and squeezed our way over and against the back wall near the corner of the room. I immediately recognized Samuel Adams at the front of the large gathering. Just seeing him reminded me of his clever plan to use the Boston Massacre as a way to incite the colonists to hate Great Britain. He was always ready to get the patriots fired up to fight against the British Empire. Tonight was no different. He was standing behind a podium with a firm scowl. He raked his fingers through his wild hair and then tried to get the attention of the raucous crowd. But the men in the room were arguing and yelling with each other. The sound was deafening, and the smell reminded me that underarm deodorant hadn't been invented yet. Might have been chilly outside, but it was warm and stuffy inside.
"Gentlemen, order! We will have order!" Samuel demanded.
Finally, the crowd calmed down, and Samuel pointed to a man who was sitting in the balcony.
"3 pence a pound is a small sum to pay for tea," said the man, who was surely a loyalist.
"It's not the cost that angers me. It is the tax that comes with the tea," yelled a patriot. "I will not pay it. The tea tax is an insult to the citizens of Boston. The British Empire does not treat us as equals. We have no representation in Parliament. They think we're fools, children, and worse, slaves."
Cam rolled his eyes. "Said ironic, isn't it?"
"Indeed," I said.
"But we must pay for the French and Indian war debt," yelled a loyalist. "If not for the king, we might all be speaking French."
Tommy whispered, "What does he mean by that?"
I whispered back, "King George sent thousands of British troops to help the colonists fight the French and the Indians. And without the king's help, the colonies would not have even been able to defend their lands and defeat the French. The king wants the colonies to help pay for that war. And that's partly why he's taxing them. The colonies believe they did pay for the war. Many gave their lives for it. But the king and Parliament feel like the colonies still owe England.
And that's why the king is taxing them," said Tommy.
"Correct," I said. "But as you can see and hear, the colonists can't agree on what's best for America."
"Sort of like the Senate and the House of Representatives in Congress today," said Cam with a smirk. "When our leaders can't agree, well, it can lead to a government shutdown." I nodded sadly.
"Yes, you're getting a taste of our future government in this very room."
Although it was cold outside, the meeting house was getting very warm, and the crowd was getting louder. Some men started shoving and pushing to get their point across.
"Mr. Revere," Tommy shouted, "maybe we should leave."
The idea was a good one, I thought. Unfortunately, we were boxed into a corner with patriots and loyalists on either side of us who looked like they were ready to come to blows. Samuel Adams tried to retain order, but he looked just as angry as the rest of them.
It was apparent that neither side was willing to back down.
"We should have the right to tax ourselves and keep it in the colonies, not send it to the king," said a patriot. "And we must not let the tea leave the ships," said another patriot. "Our colonies in Charleston and New York and Philadelphia all refused to accept the tea shipments. Boston must do the same."
Suddenly, the owner of the Dartmouth rushed back into the assembly and yelled, "I have news from the governor." He panted and said, "He is not willing to send the tea back to England. He said it must be landed and the tea tax must be paid." Patriots shouted with anger, and loyalists yelled in support of what the governor had decided. It was so loud I could barely hear my own voice. I yelled to Tommy and Cam again, "Stay close by me, this could get ugly."
"This is like a Boston Bruins ice hockey brawl," said Tommy.
Samuel Adams raised his hands to quiet the crowd, but without success. He looked like he was ready to explode.
"Hey, I have an idea," said Cam, and he pulled out the silver whistle that Paul Revere gave him.
"Good idea," said Tommy, who pulled out the whistle that Freedom gave him.
"On the count of three," Cam said. They each put the tip of their whistle in their mouths. Cam counted to three with his fingers. 1, 2, 3. And after a deep breath, the boys blew as long and as loud as they could. A high-pitched sound sliced through the room like a hot knife through butter. The siren-like sound seemed to bounce off the Old South Meeting House walls until all eyes turned toward Cam. Cam smiled, said, "I think Mr. Samuel Adams has something to say." With gratitude, Samuel nodded at Cam, but he was in no mood to smile. With a stern expression on his face, he looked out across the crowd of patriots and loyalists and said, "It is clear that we are divided among ourselves. I will only say this, gentlemen. This meeting can do nothing more to save the country." With that, Samuel Adams left the platform of the meeting house and slipped out the back door. I felt someone tap me on the shoulder. As I turned, I saw that it was my hero, Paul Revere. "Come," he said. Samuel said the secret words, "This meeting can do nothing more to save the country." We agreed that if and when he said these words, the Sons of Liberty would meet behind the Old South Meeting House. Tommy smiled and said, "Is it time for the Boston Tea Party?" Paul looked at Tommy and, while raising his eyebrows, said, "Yes, that's correct." He turned his gaze toward me and said, "Rush Revere, you agreed to be a Son of Liberty, did you not?"
Yes, I did," I said.
Paul smiled and slapped me on the back. "Good. The Sons of Liberty need good men like you, and your students are welcome to join us."
"Awesome," Tommy said. He turned to Cam and said, "You can be Robin Hood and I'll be Batman."
"No way," argued Cam. "You're Robin Hood and I'm Batman." Paul Revere interrupted. "Robin Hood is a legendary hero, fights to destroy tyranny. A bat is a creature that cowers in caves and spreads filth and disease." In unison, Tommy and Cam said, "I'm Robin Hood."
"I approve. The Sons of Liberty are very much like Robin Hood of Sherwood Forest, so come, follow me," Paul said.
We scurried along the wall and then through and around several men who were still arguing about what should be done with the tea. In less than a minute, we had reached the back door. We exited, found ourselves in the middle of 40 or 50 Indians. No, they weren't real Native Americans, but their faces were covered with red and black war paint. They had feathers in their hair, and many carried hatchets. Some were still in the process of changing from colonist to Indian, including Samuel Adams. "We need to change our appearance," said Paul, smiling. "Come. We have enough clothes for the three of you." I was thrilled to join the Sons of Liberty, disguised as Mohawk Indians, in a unified act against the British Empire. Cam turned to Tommy and whispered, "Dude, do you realize what we are about to do? We're going undercover. We're like 18th century special ops, Navy SEALs."
"Except we don't have night vision goggles," said Tommy.
But this is way better than playing a video game. I mean, we're actually here in 1773 Boston, and we are about to be a part of history.
Yeah, said Cam. Operation BTP, here we come.
This is going to be so awesome, squealed Tommy.
In a few minutes, we were all dressed like Indians.
Well, sort of.
It was a good thing it was dark, because in the daylight, I bet we looked more like Peter Pan's lost boys. In any case, we used coal dust to darken our faces and arms.
I'm just glad it's not too cold tonight, or I'd be freezing, Cam said.
I think I'll grab a couple of feathers for Liberty, I said. I'm sure he's close, and I bet he'll want to join us if he can.
Samuel Adams joined us, as others formed a circle around him. Firmly, he said, tonight we send a message to the king. If his ships will not leave Boston, so be it. But we will toss his tea overboard and let it float back to England.
And then Samuel let out a loud war whoop.
Many other war whoops echoed in response as we began marching down to Griffin's Wharf, where the three ships, the Dartmouth, the Eleanor, and the Beaver, were moored. Men shouted and cheered us on as we hurried down Milk Street.
Boston Harbor will be a teapot tonight, yelled a patriot who slapped me on the shoulder as I passed by.
The moon overhead was bright, and I was amazed at how well I could see. Was this a bit of divine intervention? Perhaps God provided the perfect weather and the perfect moon for what I hoped was a perfect tea party. Soon we were at the wharf, and I felt a cold breeze come off the water and into my face. It was dark. It was hard to see who might be looking at us. I could barely see the faces of other Sons of Liberty dressed as Mohawk Indians. It was a little spooky, especially hearing the creaking and squeaking of the boats as the sea pushed their hulls back and forth against the docks. It was like the three ships were trying to warn the British army.
Danger, squeaked the Dartmouth. Look, thieves, creaked the Beaver.
Don't let them take our precious chest of tea, groaned the Eleanor. Within minutes, we were divided up into three different groups and ready to board the three different ships. Suddenly, Liberty appeared out of nowhere and said, let's get this party started.
Liberty, we all shouted, excited that he had joined us.
It just wouldn't be the same without you, Tommy said.
Here, let me attach these feathers to your mane. Now you're an Indian horse.
I would have joined you earlier, but I was speaking with Freedom. You know, with my mind.
Wow, that is amazing, said Tommy. I didn't think that'd be possible once we passed through the time portal.
Neither did I, said Liberty, but our connection has been getting stronger and stronger.
And what did Freedom have to say, I asked.
Oh, she just asked how I was feeling after eating all those beans.
She was genuinely concerned about my well-being. That's what I like most about Freedom.
Well, that and also her name.
Hey, maybe that's why we have such a strong connection. Freedom and Liberty sort of go together, if you know what I mean.
Here come Samuel Adams and Paul Revere, I interrupted. Looks like they'll be joining us on the Dartmouth.
Liberty sighed. I'm just relieved we're not boarding the Eleanor. Seriously, I once had a great aunt, Eleanor, who loved to suck on garlic.
Did you say suck on garlic? Tommy asked.
Oh, yeah, Liberty said. She said it kept away the vampires.
Vampires? Tommy said doubtfully.
Well, vampires.